Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
How often do we think, well, that person's an idiot? My guest is the author of Office Idiots, What to Do When Your Workplace is a Jerk Place. He's a management consultant. He's taught numerous classes at UCLA's MBA program, and he's here to teach us a few things about how to deal with office idiots and maybe even recognize if we ourselves are a bit of an office idiot. Ken Lloyd, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. Are you there? Ken? I don't have you here, and I don't know what's going on. We'll just wait and see if we can resolve this technical difficulty. Let's see. Are you there? All right. Well, do we have him, or should I talk? Okay. All right. Well, let me. We'll see what we can do to get him back. And I'll give you kind of an update on the kind of things we're going to talk about, and not an update, but a kind of an advanced look. The kind of common situations where people are in the workplace kind of act badly. I wouldn't go as far as call them idiots, I suppose. I guess that's the modern trend in books. We use words like naked and idiot to try to attract attention. But certainly things like... people certainly do criticize unfairly sometimes. And sometimes, I can imagine, I know this for a fact, my boss will sometimes rarely respond to a request. I don't mean here at KLW, I mean various other places I work. For example, I might ask for feedback and not get it, or, you know, the fact that I've got to ask for feedback, or another kind of a... lousy thing that someone could do would be, let's say another team member blames you for their bad work or their lack of productivity. We're going to be talking about all those kind of things. And sometimes there are coworkers who withhold information. That's certainly something that makes often makes the coworker look good and you look bad. We'll try to deal with that if we can get the caller back. And you know, sometimes your boss is. Are you there by any chance? No, I guess he's not. Okay. We'll talk about what... should I assume, Joanne, that we're not going to have him? You don't know. Okay. So other things that that really are kind of annoying behaviors in the workplaces. Very often, not very often, only sometimes, your boss, quote, fixes your work, but actually makes it worse. Then we all know people who in the workplace give too much input. They talk too much. They ask too many questions. They give too many ideas. They criticize too much. How do you deal with such a person? Sometimes that person is not an idiot. That person really is right a lot, but simply become overwhelming after time. And then one other example that I find my clients have certainly found annoying is that people are often promised a promotion soon, so to speak, but it doesn't happen. How should an employee respond? So you could see why I was particularly looking forward to talking to my guest, Ken Lloyd. Because it looks like these technical problems are going to continue, what I'm going to do is I'm going to move into topic two, and hopefully we will get Ken back and we can go back to this topic. I had kind of promised last week that if we had time, I was going to read a little section of Chorus Line. I had seen Chorus Line, the play, recently, and there's a small scene in which the dancers talk about what they would do if they couldn't dance. And I really found that their discussion encapsulated so much of the debate that we all often have about the questions of, you know, do I follow my dream career? What if I have one short term? What do I do? you know, how realistic, quote unquote, should I be? And so I thought it might be a useful trigger for our conversation to for me to read you this this little scene. I'm not going to try to. It's about five or six different dancers, so I'm not going to try to imitate their voices at all. But I think you'll get the point, and might be an interesting trigger for our conversation, and just useful in itself. And the first person starts by saying, "What do you do when you can't dance anymore? Kill yourself? No, really. Oh crap! What kind of question is that? It's real heavy. Yeah, I know. But what do you do? I'll tell you, because I'm getting scared. I love being in this business, but one day it hits you." Okay, Richie, you've been having fun for almost 8 years now. But where's it been getting you? A lot of people are feeling that way, and they're getting out of the business fast. Well, there's no security in dancing. But wait a second. There's no promotion, no advancement. Listen, if you're looking for that kind of security, forget it. It's not just that. Well, then what? I could do without security and all, but crap, there's no work anymore. Tell me about it. It's true. Sure it is, but that isn't happening to everyone. Oh, please, I don't want to hear about how Broadway's dying, because I just got here. Don't worry, honey, it's not. They're not doing big musicals like they used to. But even if they did, even if you get this show, it's going to close one day. Nothing runs forever, right? Yeah, sure, but that's just the way it is. And then you have to start all over again, because the only chorus line you can depend on in this business is the one at the unemployment line. But don't you want to do more than just dance in the chorus? Gee, I just want to get in one. Well, I want to be something beside the tall, skinny redhead second from the end. Not that I want to be a star or anything. Hell, I do. I'm getting us. No, he's not there. He's now been hung up. So what I need to do is we need to try him back. The phone line has been disconnected. Those of you just joining us, I've had to tap dance here a little bit because we've had a technical problem. My guest is the author of a book called Office Idiots and How to Deal with Them. But unfortunately, we have had a technical problem.
Marty, can you hear me?
Oh, now I hear you fine.
And I hear you. The miracle has worked.
Wow. I am so sorry. I don't know what happened, but the important part is that you are here, and fortunately, therefore, my listeners can benefit from all the wisdom that we were hoping you would exchange. So, welcome. So let's, you are the author, just for those of you just joining, as I mentioned, Ken Lloyd's the author of Office Idiots, and the subtitle is What to Do When Your Workplace is a Jerk Place, How to Deal with Difficult People. So let's start out with something that's current. Last week, AOL's CEO Tim Armstrong got a lot of heat for firing his creative director, Abel Lenz, during a meeting. And during the meeting, Lenz was laughing at the fact that an AOL subsidiary called Patch.com had lost millions of dollars, and Armstrong told him to stop. But Lenz didn't stop, and Armstrong fired him on the spot, partly because he was angry, but partly because Armstrong didn't want the staff to think that he could be abused like that treat the business so trivially. The media, however, has been really critical of Tim Armstrong. They said he should have fired him privately. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I actually agree with the media on this one. I know that he apologized afterwards, recognizing that he kind of lost a little control there. But absolutely, if you want to be firm and tough and strong and take an action that really seems appropriate, all the way out to terminating someone, it's not really to be done in front of an audience. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's not right.
Hmm. I guess I'm emotionally tone deaf. If I had 10 people working for me and one of my workers was laughing about the fact that we lost millions of dollars, and he was, by the way, he had a camcorder and he was deciding to videotape the proceedings, I think that is, I would just, we have to agree to disagree. I think that net, greater good accrues from the firing right there, even if it was, quote, a violation of privacy. Privacy is not a trump card that trumps everything. It's a factor that needs to be weighed against everything else, in my judgment. You completely disagree with that, huh?
No, I don't totally disagree. I mean, look, privacy, I think, in the world today is all but gone. I mean, there's just no privacy anywhere. But at the same time, we still should have a little bit of respect, a little bit of trust, treating people that we've worked with over all these years with some degree of fairness. And to me, just to jump on top of someone like that, berate in front of everyone, it just makes the president of the company, makes the CEO look like as big a fool. There's no need to put himself in that kind of position.
I don't know. I think that worker was the one who was unfair and abusive, and to expect managers to be saintly. And frankly, I would think even if I had complete control, it wasn't like necessarily I wasn't there, but I don't think even if I was completely in control of myself, and if I'm interested in is creating a wonderful workplace, and my 10 supervisees are seeing somebody laugh that in a public meeting that we lost $10 million, taking video of it and refusing to stop, I think that net, my company and my workers are going to be better off if I did fire him summarily and they all saw it right there. I could be wrong. Anyway, let's move off that. Certainly, and implicit almost in what I said, is that there's some people who just lose control. And that's the problem. They know the right thing to say. They know how to, they could write article after article about how to be tactful. But when something unfair happens, when they feel they're being screwed, in the moment, they go from 0 to 60 in 2 seconds. They get furious fast, and they just can't restrain themselves from just, lashing back at the person. I mean, obviously, the obvious advice is, you're supposed to walk out of the room and cool down. But in the real world, in practice, some people, especially those who have a big adrenal gland, just don't have the restraint to do that. Any advice for those people who go from 0 to 60 in 2 seconds?
Yeah, Marty, that's such a great question, too. Look, nothing really great happens when we lose control. It
sure.
Really doesn't. We say and do things we really regret and have to apologize.
We know that, but we can't control ourselves.
But I think one thought to keep in mind, there's no easy one on this, as you know, but one thought to keep in mind is I can pretty well predict how people are going to behave in various situations if I know them. I know who's the high achiever. I know who's the hard worker. I know who's going to be causing a little bit of trouble. What I want to do going into a situation is be ready for that. So when this person acts in a way that may be disruptive, mm-hmm. I already am set for it. So mm-hmm. I will be in a better position to deal with it with a little bit more rationality and control.
Good point. Okay. Now, while I was waiting to get you online, I kind of let the listeners know that what are the topics we were going to cover, some of the common situations where people in the workplace tend to act badly. So what's your advice on how to respond to each of these? We'll take them one at a time. Let's say you are criticized unfairly. What should you do?
Just fire the person on the spot. Everybody. Yeah, if you're criticized unfairly, to me, I like to let the facts and the data really speak for themselves. If I have any documentation, if I have email, if I have memos, or if I just have sheer factual information, I try to let the facts do the talking rather than simply saying, hey, it's not fair, you're being mean, or any of that. Let's deal with facts, figures, behavior, and data and not get into just general emotional stuff in those kinds of situations.
Okay, I think that's great. Like, of course, that's why in some workplaces people carry on a memo pad or scrambling notes about each example of bad behavior, which can also chill the workplace. But I think I make that point make sense. Let's go to another example. When a boss, I must admit, this is a personal one too. I like feedback. And I prefer not to have to ask for it because I sound needy. But the boss never gives feedback. I work pretty hard and I'm eager for feedback and I never get anything. What should you do?
Well, sometimes, particularly in senior levels of these companies, a lot of the feedback, fortunately or unfortunately, is going to be from the results we generate. We know how we're doing. In order to gather it from a manager without sounding, again, like you're needy or dependent or insecure, you can kind of do it as part of another communication. Hey, just wanted to make sure that you got the report that I did and it worked out for you. And the person might just say, yeah, that's fine. And from that person, that might be as good as it's going to get. Mm-hmm. You kind of have to know who you're dealing with. Because there's the other extreme. Some managers give way too much, constantly feedback. Mm-hmm. Great job, wonderful, keep it up. And that's kind of about as valuable as the background noise of the air conditioning. So there is a middle ground in this.
Yeah, I like the wording you used. How'd that work for you? Rather than say, I would like some feedback on this, which gives just a little more. I mean, it's fine. It's great. I've done that myself. But, sometimes maybe how'd that work out for you makes the person feel under less pressure to, write a detailed evaluation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, your other point that you mentioned parenthetically, indeed, is that there is this gratuitous kind of feedback. Too many people have taken intro to psych and they're told praise, praise, praise. And while there are some employers who don't praise at all because they're afraid it's going to make the person feel complacent or ask for a raise, there are some who are just from the school of, you know, oh, yes, you know, I like the way you're sitting, Johnny, like a second grade teacher. And that can be, you know, make people roll their eyes. So it's a great point, too. Next, there is often the case, you know, you're very often weak team members will figure out a smart way to do it is to the best defense is a good offense. So they blame you for their bad behavior or their bad work or lack of productivity. They say, if only you did this, you know, they'd be fine. How do you deal with that kind of an employee? Coworker?
Yeah, you know, blaming or finger pointing is one of the worst things that goes on in organizations today, and it's so common. I'm not sure why it's so prevalent out there, but I mean one strategy is to say whatever is going on with the blame is the blaming. My hope would be, all right, what's happening has happened. Let's figure out how we're going to prevent this from happening in the future. And as we talk about that, it'll be a little clearer as to what actually happened and where the fault may have actually been placed in the past and where it was actually deservedly placed. But more importantly, instead of dwelling, you did this, but you said that, but this was yours, let's figure out how going down the road we're not going to have this kind of mess again.
You gave an example of that with some person. It was a team that was responsible for creating some computer code, and you did most of it, and it was fine, and then it was one little thing, and this other person did all the blamed you for the whole delay on the software delivery. What would you say exactly in that situation? Let's get to some more concrete example so we're not living in the world of the abstract here.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think I'd be inclined to kind of do the instant replay. Let's really walk through this and see exactly what happened so we can clarify where the problems may have occurred and, again, setting the framework to prevent them from happening in the future. And as we go over what happened in the past, guess what? It's going to be clear without saying, you did this, let's talk about what happened, and we'll see really where the, quote, blame really should have been placed. But more importantly, we are coming up with a strategy, hopefully, to prevent the problem again.
Yeah, and that is really important. You know, it's a standard practice, but most standard advice, but most people don't follow it. You know, America is a land of self-esteem, and we don't like to be criticized. Even, you know, there are other countries where it's the norm and it's seen as critical to growth, but for some reason, the core culture here is you don't want to be blamed. And so your point about blaming, you know, we had a problem here, this occurred, avoiding the word you and what you did, but just speaking in the third party as obfuscatory as that really is, and it's not, it's disingenuous in some ways, it's nonetheless the way one must function in America. Is that a fair statement?
I think, unfortunately, it is. I mean, I agree with you completely on the self-esteem thing. I mean, it starts out so early, you know, with every child on the soccer team gets a trophy, and
right.
A trophy for showing up, and a trophy
right.
for running and for walking, and it becomes meaningless, but then they get almost addicted to that type of
Correct.
A thing.
Correct.
And then we end up with very, very needy adults, and hopefully we can wean them from a little bit of that while at the same time taking the strategy that you and I just talked about to deal with the problem.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Ken Lloyd. He's the author of Office Idiots, What to Do When Your Workplace is a Jerk Place. By the way, I have a problem with the word jerk because it's always, you know, when I say the word jerk, what comes to mind for most people is a man. And there are office idiots of both genders, and just I feel I needed to strike that blow for gender equity.
Yeah, it's an equal opportunity label without a doubt. Yeah.
By the way, dear listeners, normally I would want to take a couple of phone calls here, but we are having technical difficulties that preclude that. So you're stuck with Ken and me. And hopefully that in the context of all these questions, Ken is doing a great job of being concise. We will therefore be able to cover a lot of ground in our segment, and hopefully your question will be indirectly answered at least. Another of the common problems that people face in the workplace with idiots or office idiots, or at least, you know, let's use the self-esteem, office less than excellent performers, is a coworker who withholds information. Again, it's rational from a purely pragmatic sense. If a coworker, especially if it's a weak coworker, withholds information from you, that tends to make the coworker look good relative to you. How do you deal with a coworker who uses the withholding of information as a weapon?
Yeah, that's interesting. It's almost a form of control and a power
right.
play as well. I can put myself above you by
right.
withholding info that you need.
Right.
The key thing in this type of situation, as in many when you're dealing with office idiots, is to be assertive about it. If you let it go, it's only going to get
mm-hmm.
worse. They're
mm-hmm.
going to withhold more. They're going to make you look worse and worse.
Right.
Again, this is the type of thing where you would focus on the specifics of the situation and say, here's what occurred. here's what I needed. I need more information as to how in the future I can get this type of information from you so we don't run into this kind of crisis. Mm-hmm. But you have to tackle it, and that's about as head-on as you can get. You don't want to say, hey, you kept this willfully from me. I know you did it to make yourself look good and me look bad. Fine, you want to fight? That's what you're going to have, but you're not going to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm. I'm hearing a theme already that there is kind of a basic model to how you believe in dealing with bad behavior at work. You want to run, if you had to create a kind of present a generic model of the 5 steps, if you will, to dealing with bad behavior in an office, can you run by what the general model would be?
Yeah, I think the model would be to recognize it for what it is, and to speak to the person about it from the standpoint of how to correct it, but importantly to focus on tangibles, results, numbers, outcomes, objectives, even behaviors, and not get into personality and mm-hmm. labeling the person. You know, you did this because you're mean and untrustworthy and unfair. That's not where you want to go. But to talk specifically about what actually occurred in terms of measurable data, and then say, all right, what are we going to do to prevent the problem?
You know, too often we know that talking to somebody about it results in a short-term improvement and a long-term reversion back to to his typical behavior or her typical behavior. Any guidance on at what point it is wise to go to the boss?
Yeah, I mean, in some cases, actually, depending on the situation, I know you've written a lot about situational management and all that really applies here. In some cases, you want to go to the boss right out of the chute. Mm-hmm. If the behavior is so egregious and the person is so out of control or in a position where you can't do a thing about it and it's serious, you're going to go to the boss right there. In many situations, the first step is going to be to deal directly with mm-hmm. the person. But you make a decision. You know, is this one where I really need to go up the ladder right now? Or I think I have a shot at correcting it myself, so I'm going to step in and take some assertive action.
Yep. Makes sense. Another common case of where people act badly in the workplace is your boss, in an attempt to justify his or her existence, takes your stuff and invariably makes corrections. And sometimes, of course, they're wonderful, and that's terrific. But what should you do if your boss is fixing your work actually makes it worse?
That is so common, and it is so absolutely absurd. That's kind of a control thing, too. You know, I want to put my little spin on this thing and make it really great. A couple of approaches. One is to suggest to the boss, to say, look, I know you're doing this. I can save you a lot of time. You don't really have to. Let it go out as I've written. In fact, let's give it a try. Let's just, for the next thing that I write, let's have you not make any changes to it and see how it flies. And if it works, then maybe we can keep that as a regular. And importantly, this will save you a bunch of your hours. You don't have to be doing this. So in other words, people like to see, what's in it for me? What's in it for the boss if this person goes along with what you're suggesting? And the other step is to get sit down with your boss and say, you did this wrong, you did that wrong. That usually doesn't fly well. I would try initially to go in a more positive way and say, let's, on a trial basis, people try a lot of things. It's a great way to start the process. See if we can go without having the person make those changes.
Those two of those principles, that do try it on a trial basis and depersonalizing it. People just don't react well to criticism. This is one that I've heard from so many of my clients. I'm a career counselor, and there's so many of my clients who say this. There are just some people who are quite smart, but they are just overwhelming. Too much input. They talk too much, have too many ideas, ask too many questions, criticize too much. So obviously, if it's an idiot, it's another story. But let's say the person is really quite bright, ideationally fluent, well-intentioned, but just overwhelming. How would you deal with that?
Yeah, it's funny because you mentioned so many of the folks that come in with constant ideas and suggestions and hearing themselves talk aren't really all that sharp, and they're doing it more to get their words out than to really help make improvements. If the person is really as bright as you say, but they go overboard, at some point, and it might be with a couple of other coworkers, to sit down maybe at lunch and kind of have a heart to talk, and you'd phrase it in a positive way. Your ideas are so great, and we can really use them. We really appreciate them. But in the persuasive process, there's something called overselling. You don't have to push it as much as you do. We get it. We can move along and take quicker action on the stuff that you're suggesting. Once again, trying to tell a person, this is how you're going to be even more effective. And sometimes, they're carrying an awful lot of baggage behind that, and it can be difficult to get through. in other cases, people are just reluctant to give them that type of feedback, and they need to hear it. But you may want to bring a posse in with you. It might be easier that way.
I'm not so sure. You know, I like that concept of sometimes you need to bring support, so it's not all on you to give the feedback. But I think that sometimes that really smart, well-intentioned, if over-intense person is one of the greatest assets a workplace has. And if he gets that little, you know, that little speech, oh, we get it. Well, maybe workers don't get it. Really smart people realize that the general workers may not get it. I'd be more inclined to, if I was his or her boss, try to give, not try to squelch him, but keep it from that worker dispiriting the rest. So I'd say, you know, privately, you are an extraordinarily bright guy or woman, of course. And there's often in meetings just not enough time. And often your being so brilliant can be dispiriting to perhaps those who aren't quite as brilliant. But I'm very eager to get your input. I want you to have an open email door to me. Email me all your ideas. I welcome them, your questions, your criticisms, your comments. And in meetings, be a little more judicious. Which are the ones that are going to yield the most bang for the buck, the best use of our time? How does that feel, Joe or Mary? What do you think about that approach?
Oh, I like that approach a lot. I mean, because look at it. If the person is as bright as you're saying, we don't want to squelch the person. We don't want to all of a sudden have the person say, fine, they don't care about what I'm saying or thinking. Yep. Who cares? So, no, I agree. You want to keep them thinking and contributing. At the same time, too much of a good thing is possible. You can have too much of a good thing because all of a sudden it takes over and stops others who may want to hitchhike on this person's good ideas. And it prevents them from saying anything. So it can be too much. So the person does need some guidance in that. I like the idea of keeping that open email. I think that's another very good way to go.
Something that really, when my clients tell me this, I get very, I shake my head. So often, I think about this guy who works for, I'm not going to say the company, I'll just make it, it's not this company, it's Oracle. It's not Oracle, but I'm saying it's Oracle. It's a company of that size and magnitude and tech and all that. And he has been an excellent performer, and he was promised a promotion a year ago. It didn't happen. He's a really laid-back guy. He waited 4 months, asked again, I'm really sorry, we're going through a lot of changes and whatever. It's going to happen. It's now been over a year. He has now quit and gone to work for somebody else. What should somebody do if they are promised a promotion but it never seems to happen?
Yeah, I think one way to do it, if you find this seems to be the tendency in the company that these promises or commitments are made, which, by the way, companies are crazy to be making, but that's a separate story. But if it has been made, I would send something like a self-serving email. Hey, I really enjoyed our discussion today, and thanks so much for mentioning this about my promotion forthcoming. I'm really looking forward to it. In fact, along the way, here's what I'm going to be doing to be better prepared. In other words, get it into writing. Mm-hmm. They're not going to write you an email saying, hey, I promise you today, but you can confirm the conversation. Just now you've got another piece of documentation, because memories can get very short when it comes to that.
I think, by the way, we may have our technical problems sufficiently fixed that we may be able to take calls. Let's give it a shot. Dear listeners, I am talking with Ken Lloyd. He's the author of Office Idiots, What to Do When Your Workplace is a Jerk Place. If you are having a problem with your boss or a coworker or a supervisee, we welcome your call. I'm sure that Ken would be happy to help you, and I might be able to, might not be able to resist throwing my two cents in as well. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko for a problem that you're having with a coworker, boss, or supervisee, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While we're waiting for the calls to come in, another common problem is that there are cliques that form in many workplaces, and they self-segregate. And they could include the boss. And they treat people who are not a part of that clique unfairly. They don't hire them. They don't promote them. They don't give them plum assignments. They make them do extra work. They let their buddies on the inside slide and go home early and take long lunches or whatever and give them cushy assignments. But the other person who's outside the clique is working like a dog. What should you do if you're outside of said clique?
Yeah, and this happens. This happens when employees are new to a company and the existing employees have formed their own little clique. It happens in a lot of different ways. Yeah. One thought to keep in mind is that you're not going to be able to convince an entire group that you should really be part of it. That's very difficult. Mm-hmm. However, every group has its own informal leaders, kind of the natural leaders of the group. And as they go, so goes the group. And it's not too tough to identify who those folks are. Mm-hmm. If you're going to try to make inroads to become part of that group, and that's a big question in and of itself, if you really want to do it. But if so, you want to identify those natural leaders and get into their camp. Learn what they're like. Learn what they're about. Listen to them. Let them get to know you and how smart you are and sharp you are and effective you are and what a good friend you are. Let them get to see what you're like, and you get them on your side. They'll sell you into the group.
Yeah. Sometimes I've seen, you know, in some workplaces, it's so dysfunctional. Being too smart, being too capable, too efficacious actually is what turns people off. When groups form cliques, it's often because they do believe strength in numbers. They're not the brightest or the hardest working or the most low maintenance. And so they form a little self-protective clique on them and puts a moat around themselves. So am I correct that sometimes you don't really want to be in the clique, or if you do, trying to show how smart and efficacious you are may make them want to, you know, raise the drawbridge on the moat even more?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I said right at the outset, is this really, if you really do want to join this clique in the first place? Because there's some that are threatened by new people on the block because they're working slowly. They've got every shortcut. They're doing a real second-rate job. But you're going to come in there, and you're going to show them all up. Is that something you really want to be part of? You'd probably be better staying away from that clique. So you kind of have to make a judgment as to what that clique is really all about. But if these are, for whatever reason, not the low achievers of the company or of the department, but the high achievers, then you might want to take some of the kinds of steps we talked about.
Yeah. Speaking of low performers, some of it, whether you're the boss or you're a coworker, it's very frustrating when there is a coworker whose work is routinely poor quality, just poor thinking skills. It's kind of illogical, and they don't produce a lot of work, and maybe they're late a lot. It's like usually it's a constellation. Those things tend to go together. Let's say in this case you're the boss. We've been focusing primarily on issues where the employee is frustrated with the boss or whatever, but let's flip it around to be fair. Let's say you are the boss, and you have a chronically not good employee. And in so many workplaces, it's just not possible to fire them for whatever reasons. It's just very difficult. And you're stuck with them. What should you do?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I know in some organizations, it is much tougher to get rid of people than others. Nonetheless, across the board, the idea is to give this person initially some informal feedback. In other words, a sit-down session to say, look, I want to talk to you about performance. Here's what I'm observing. And again, fact, figure, outcome, result, goals met, goals not met, all performance-based. And if that doesn't work, then give them the written warning. And in that, state the consequences. And if a person is truly not meeting job standards, job specifications, you can put a great motivator into them by putting it in writing and saying, look, here's what we've seen, here's what's going on, and here are the consequences. And in many companies where employees today are all at-will employees anyhow, to put in, look, if this continues, more severe disciplinary action will be taken, up to and including termination. There is a time when that needs to go on. Granted, it's tougher in some companies than others, but that does need to happen. It has to be out there.
Yeah. And in some nonprofits and government agencies especially, and in some companies, it's just the amount of effort and time that it takes to dismiss an employee, the amount of due process is so onerous. And then that worker then ends up stirring up the rest of the workers to claim false, make false claims about the boss. It becomes easier to just let the person stay. I want to propose what you propose, frankly, is the standard advice, and it's often correct, but it also too often leads to a lawsuit and other negative side effects. What I am a huge fan of is counseling out. If I find after a reasonable amount of attempt to remediate an employee, I want to then start the process of relationship building. Writing somebody up and giving them a warning about consequences does not, it becomes an extraordinarily adversarial relationship. And unfortunately, many people, especially weak performers, don't realize they're weak performers, and they deflect the blame onto you. So with such employees, it may often be wiser to try to build a relationship of trust, to be working with the person, to be as positive as possible, but also to slowly and subtly suggest that maybe they would be happier and more successful in another position. And getting that person to trust that that's true, and you're not lying at all, that is absolutely the truth, and getting the person to voluntarily say, Maybe if you would help me find another job somewhere else that's more appropriate, I would go. Or he or she would ask for a package, you know, a severance package. Getting that person to do it voluntarily is probably, in my mind, a less stressful and often more efficacious approach, and ultimately might help the person find better suited employment. What's your reaction?
Yeah, I think what you've got actually is a whole menu of options here to deal with people whose performance is really below par. And you know, one, I certainly like the option of doing the kind of counseling that you're talking about. At the same time, I've seen situations where employees have gotten fairly severe and strict warnings, and they've awakened, and they've realized, oh my gosh, this is really serious. And if I don't step up and start performing, bad things are going to happen. Again, I don't like the idea of fear as a motivator. You know, fear is a very nice short-term motivator, but it doesn't do a lot of good stuff long-term.
Right.
But there are cases where, you know what, it's a wake-up call. It's a warning, and I really think I need to get going. And so we can get good results out of that as well. But I certainly like the positive and constructive counseling approach you're talking about as well.
All right. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko with Ken Loy, the author of Office Idiots. What is your question or comment for him? It's your turn. Hi. On the air. Hi.
Hi, my name is Henry. I've been listening, and I'm recognizing a lot of the dynamics in the situation I was just in, and I have been through, for the record. And as they showed up in my situation, they're very they tend to be very covert, very unspoken actions. And what this all pointed to for me, what my takeaway from my situation was, was what I've heard from your guest, is that what I've heard from your guest backs up that we've got to be proactive.
Mm-hmm.
And proaction has to start. You said not too long ago, get something in writing, you know. Well, really, start sooner. Get something verbally, you know. Find out what effect you're having. I came into a situation where the position was basically developed for me. Mm-hmm. And my skill set was said, you're a good skill set. We'll try you. And we'll give you the support you need, and we'll let you go at it. We'll give you some things to do. But I was assigned to work with other teams. And when I went for help, when I went to look for help on, or just to get some direction from the teams, it was not forthcoming. And that's pretty much the basis of that situation. And that's what led to my takeaway after about a month and an evaluation was said, this isn't working out, sorry. I thought to myself, well, it was my lack of proaction. I needed to go to those teams. I needed to make myself, I needed to force some reciprocation from the work floor.
Ken, what would you, any other advice you would give in this situation?
Yeah, well, I certainly, when you mention dealing with it verbally before writing, sure, that's the first course, but sometimes the only problem is we will verbally agree to something and then, well, I never said that. And then it's a he said, she said. If you sense you're in a situation that's really critical, as the one you described, it's probably helpful to get something in documented as well. Just get something written down so you don't get into this back and forth thing. It sounded like that might have been going on in part of your situation, too.
So you got let go. And I'm sorry, you please go ahead. What were you going to say?
This is a two-way situation. I would completely acknowledge that. You know, we didn't pull our ends together and make this position work. But if I would have been more proactive from the beginning, I'd going, what's working for you guys? And rather than getting crickets and waiting for someone to come in obliquely with a project for me and then walking away and coming back and taking the project, and then I'm hearing from somewhere else about the feedback of that project, my advice to anybody, and I'm a design professional. This is a design floor with teams of designers of who I was handling content for. And especially in a critical environment like that, be proactive. Put yourself forward. Make sure they know what you want, what your effect is. Make sure, don't leave them for them to bring it up later.
Yeah. Henry, thank you.
It's not about forcing agreements. It's just about getting that response.
Thank you. I appreciate that call. Any other example, Ken, of proactivity that can set the right stage for you, for your coworkers and bosses and whatever being less problematic?
Yeah, I think obviously depending on the situation, even if something as basic as you're in your office or your workstation and you're trying to get your job done, and in comes the nonstop talker. This is the person who just wants to just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. Okay. Now, no one's going to get fired over this. It's not a big crisis. At the same time, you've got work to do. You can sit there and stop what you're doing and listen, then have to go all the way back and get your work started, or you can kind of do what Henry was just saying. Again, be proactive. Say, sorry, this is not a good time. Maybe we can talk a little bit later. If you let the nonstop talker talk, it's going to go on and on and on, and they're going to actually think, hey, this is okay, and now you're rewarding this behavior, so you're going to just see more of it. So this assertiveness, taking action to deal with office idiots, cuts across the whole spectrum of what these folks are doing.
Okay. Two more questions, and we really have to stop. We've already kind of gone over time here. First, I want to ask about job seekers. Many people who listen to this show, because the show focuses on work, are looking for a job or would like to work for a job. And in these tough times, it's not so easy to find one. And so it's very tempting to, and you write about this in your book, Office Idiots, to be unethical. They will exaggerate their training. They'll exaggerate their work history. They'll say they were a consultant where they weren't. They figure the worst thing that can happen is they get discovered and they don't get the job, or they weren't going to get the job anyway if they were fully forthcoming. You can't appeal to ethics to those people because they're clearly trying. They've made a decision to be pragmatic. How would you, if you were their mentor and advisor, how would you attempt to deal with such a job seeker?
Yeah, I would certainly recommend going the honest route, but I would make sure that your resume, and if you're going to include a cover letter, is really well put together to highlight the strengths that are really sought in the job that you're applying for. And rather than fabricating, and it's certainly going as far as conferring a degree on yourself that you don't have, you'd be much better served by networking, taking the time to talk to people who are out there working, expanding your work, doing some work in the community, because then if you're unemployed, suddenly instead of having to lie about being a consultant, you are one. You're doing some pro bono work. You're increasing your network. You're building your resume. But I would stay away from the dishonesty completely, because it is going to come out. And even if you're lucky enough to get the job, they'll let you go for that. You'll sign a doc saying anything that I falsified as part of the application process is grounds for immediate termination. It's just not worth it.
And there's always so many levels on which you can justify ethical behavior. The optimistic side of me says that we tend to just lose sight of what we learned in church or what our parents taught us or whatever in the fear that we have of being a bag lady. And so we start to do things that are unethical, that we would not want to tell our son or daughter that we were doing, that we would not feel good about putting our head on the pillow. But while I'm an atheist, I do think that what they talk about in church is cosmically right, not just because it's the right thing to do, but cosmically, is that really the way you want to go through life? And ultimately, I've seen many clients use radical honesty, including about their employment gaps, that ultimately, yeah, many employees will be turned off by that. But the right employer, who's thirsting for finally a little bit of integrity in this ever more dishonest world, will say yes, and then you can feel better about the way your life is living. It's like the kids who start cheating to get into college. They go and hire somebody to write their college application essay or whatever. It's just starting down a path toward just feeling like you are just sleazy. So I would always try to start by appealing to the very highest and cosmic values within people. Am I being too sanctimonious here?
No, I think you're being appropriate. I think you're being ethical. I think you're being fair. And I think this is productive. I think this is actually how to help people get a job. In fact, I had read about an individual who had recommended that people, if you have a failure, put it in your resume.
I do. I do that all the time.
And because the employer goes, gee, this person must be really honest, must be really confident, must really feel secure in himself or herself to be able to do this. So it's really to go on the side of honesty, in my opinion, Marty, is absolutely the way to go.
And even at a higher level, you want to find the right job. Because if you're BS your way into a job that you're not likely to be the best candidate, you're going to do a worse job potentially. A person who is more worthy for the job is not going to get it. The organization is going to do a less good job, whether it's a nonprofit or a company. Cosmically, it is ultimately we want to find our place in the world. It's like if I were single and I was looking to meet a woman, I wouldn't have one of these stupid obfuscatory pictures where it's a long far a picture that doesn't reveal how old I am because it's in the distance. Or I'd use a 20-year-old picture. I would try to I would use an absolutely realistic picture, just because it's cosmically right. But we digress. Anyway, I don't want to hear this is Sunday, but I still don't want to sound like a minister. Okay. Implicit in much of what you said, if I'm thinking back on this interview, and all your general, the notion is that you really do need to kind of sugarcoat things. You need to avoid blaming the person. You need to talk about a problem as an external problem, that we how are we going to deal with it together, all this positivity. That is kind of the archetypal foundation of how people should interact with each other in the workplace. Be nice. Face save for people. Sugarcoat. Praise where possible. Is there evidence? You have a PhD. You've taught at UCLA. Is there evidence that doing that, as opposed to being very direct, here's the facts, here's what you did, straighten up, da-da-da-da, being very direct, is there good evidence to suggest that the sugarcoating and the face-saving and all that ultimately does result in a better workplace, a more productive workplace?
Yeah, I'm not sure if just straight sugarcoating and face-saving and constant recognition is going to do any company or any individual any good. I'm saying to start out, rather than going right to plan B and then writing the kind of memo that I mentioned, saying, look, continuation is going to lead to severe discipline. It could even get you to get you terminated. To start out by talking about the issues, the problems, the actual behaviors, and the steps to take to correct it. If that doesn't work, and maybe resorting to the kind of counseling that you're talking about in other situations, but if this doesn't work, there is a time where every manager, if it's a managerial kind of decision, needs to become more firm, more direct, more targeted, because that's what management is. It's not just being the tough, hard guy, and it's not just being the rollover, the sugarcoater. You have to look at the person, the situation, the problem, the resources, and make your decision. You know, when the Titanic hit the iceberg, it was not the time to say, you know what, let's have some meetings. We need to talk about the levels of ice. We should talk about the crew. Let's solve the problem. Direct, firm, strong leadership. Other cases, we can have a lot more delegation and make it, if you will, far more sugarcoated.
It actually reduces to one word, doesn't it? Art. Every field, whatever you're in, whether you're a dentist or you're a manager or you're a career counselor, mastery is involved in situational decision-making. There are few rules. This is not like the Ten Commandments, where it's black and white. Those should not be viewed as black and white. There are conditions under which robbing and killing may even be appropriate. Would anybody argue that somebody shouldn't have tried to kill Adolf Hitler when he was in process? Is it not correct that in the end, everything comes down to nuance and stop with the black and white thinking?
You know, I think, as you said, management is an art, and we have to look at the overall situation, all the variables are in it, and then try to make the best decision based on all the data that we can gather. In some cases, it's going to be strong and tough and firm. Other cases, it'll be a little bit lighter and a little more sugar-coated, and all points in between.
Well, I'm glad that I made the choice to have you as my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. Thanks for giving me part of your Sunday, Ken.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Good. The book is Office Idiots, What to Do When Your Workplace is a Jerk Place. It is filled with very practical ideas, and it's really, I think, his point about preparing in advance. It's very hard in the heat of the moment to know the kind of thing to say, and taking the hour or two, it's a simple read book, relatively short, 200 pages, taking the time to read and think about the office, I don't know about idiots, but the difficult people who you deal with in your life, both at work and out, and kind of having a little template in advance ready to go, may make it easier to deal with them. So anyway, thanks again, Ken, if you're still with us. If not,
still here. Thank you very much.
Okay,
Marty.
You be well, Ken.
You too.
Bye-bye. Okay, we've got only a small amount of time left, but I want to devote it to you, of course. Now, if you have any kind of problem with your work life, whether you're unemployed or well-employed and still unhappy, self-employed, working for government, nonprofit, and you're looking for a little career advice, you are stuck, I do what are called 3-minute workovers. If the problem is a career tweak or needs a completely radical makeover, I can usually be of help. This is the time to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, 415 841 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And I'm going to make an executive decision. When we were having technical difficulties, partly to tap dance, I started reading us a little excerpt from Chorus Line, a play I saw, a wonderful play at Woodminster, which talks about the plight that people have in what to do when they can't have their dream career or when their dream career dries up. But I'm not going to start from the beginning. That feels like redundancy. And if I start in the middle, it's not going to be enough. So I'm going to just let that go. I guess it wasn't meant to be. So let's go right to the phones. All my lines are lighted up. So all of a sudden, so let's go right to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hi, it's you.
My name is Elizabeth, and I work for in a company, a large company in a group that I quite like. And respect people for the most part, but I'm faced with looking forward to having someone as a manager whose work I don't respect. I like the person immensely, but the idea of having them manage me is really problematic.
What's making it problematic for you?
They do very poor work. Mm-hmm. And I've cleaned up after them a lot, mm-hmm. and it's difficult for me to swallow working for someone whose work is shoddy and to see them advance.
And
I don't get it.
And there are many, unfortunately, in our society today, there are many factors other than merit which do result in a person getting promoted. So as you know, maybe it's easy. I know it's easier said than done. You can't change that, right? That is, you know, the serenity prayer. God grant me the wisdom to know the difference between what I can and can't change. Am I correct? You're not going to get him or her unpromoted. Is that correct?
In all probability, yes.
And it sounds like you like your job, and so you don't want to quit. Therefore,
I do. Yeah.
Right. So therefore, the problem resides within you. There are always things that are going to make us feel crappy. And this is now a time to replace your resentment of him or her with gratitude for having a good job. Minimize, you know, and either if she does crappy work clearly or he, you're certainly clearly not going to want to rely on that person at all. So you're going to try to skirt around. You're not going to try to get feedback or advice from that person. You're going to get your retribution, if you will, by simply finding your mentorship or management from somebody else. Is that realistic or unrealistic?
No, I think that's fine. I can do that.
All right. I love that you called, though, Elizabeth. I wish you the best.
Thanks very much.
Take care. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Well, I was just going to talk about how I got my job. The way I got my last job is by what do you call it, in the restaurant industry, staging.
In the what industry? I didn't hear what kind of industry. What kind of industry? Well, we lost him. I guess we've lost him. Okay, let's go to the next line. Sorry about that. Feel free to call back. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, Marty. My name is Susan. I'm struggling with, I just recently left a three-year project, whether I should pursue these full-time opportunities that I'm able to find that I'm well qualified for, but don't really pique my interest in what I'm wanting to do is really develop and find what it is that does pique my interest. Mm-hmm. I'm extremely well qualified in education equity, nonprofits, project management, but I feel like I'm waiting for that magic fit, and I'm doing lots of info interviews, talking with all of my network people, I'm doing all the right stuff, but I still seem to be floundering, and I'm not really sure what to do with myself.
Let's look at internal. I'm going to give you a multiple choice question. In your heart of hearts, do you think the problem is that you're burned out and don't want to work for a while and you need to take a break? Is it that you are looking for more control and a more powerful position? Is there a particular cause that you believe in? Any of those feel like a good starting place for our discussion?
Well, I definitely am burnt out, and I think I need to deal with my money fear and just give myself like a month off, mm-hmm. and I do have a partner who's supportive of that.
Okay.
So part of it is money fear. I do need to get unburnt. And then the next is that, yes, I think I need to indulge my creativity and just really explore. And I do want to have more control, but I'm worried if I have the chops to be an independent consultant to really go after the stuff that I want to do.
Okay, well, let's talk about it. Let's say I staked you with $2 million and you could be a consultant that utilize your creativity, have more control. Do you know what kind of work you would do?
Not sure. I have 25 years in education equity. I'm not sure if I would continue to do that.
You probably wouldn't. If you wouldn't be making this call because you've obviously explored that up, down, and sideways. Right. And does your heart of hearts say you're going to be in a nonprofit or not in a nonprofit environment, whether as an employee or a consultant?
Nonprofit.
In a nonprofit environment. And if I gave you $5 million, and that's the good news, and the bad news is you have to give it away to a nonprofit, who would you give it to?
Oh, I would do youth villages or other ones that help families and help children. I think I know what I want to do. I'm just trying to muster the courage to explore it and believe I have the professional chops
okay.
to really do it.
If I am the CEO of Youth Villages and I say to you, Susan, I will give you any job you want as long as it helps you flower and you get excited and passionate about it. What would you want to do for me?
I want to be your right-wing gal. I want to be your VP. You have the vision. I make it happen.
Great.
I know exactly what I'm good at.
Good. So you're going to. So what kind of things in your job description, what would be the top two or three things in your job description as my right arm, what would you do for me?
I would do vision implementation. I would, I'm not sure how to go beyond implementation. I'm kind of a Jill of all trades.
Okay. So you're more of an operations person, a person who would get stuff done. Somebody else provides the vision, and you're going to implement that general vision and making it happen. You're going to plan out the timelines. You're going to supervise the people. You're going to make it happen. Is that correct?
Yes, that's what I do.
Okay. And is that what you want to do, or is that dispiriting?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Yeah, you don't want to do it. Let's do something else. Let's talk about the creativity side. Let's say you were you care about children, right?
Yes.
Right. And does it matter what their particular problem is, or their age, or their gender, or their sexual orientation, or any of that stuff? How would you break down the world of children that would potentially get you excited? I don't care about what you've done in the past. Right. Now we're trying to re-energize you. What would be exciting? Would you be one-on-one? Would it be good? What to find the parameters that would narrow down your work with children? Would it be indirect? Would it be direct service? What's the parameters that would get you excited?
Low-income families, families of color, families lacking services that people of privilege can get, upper middle-class white folk. I want to do work that makes a difference for them and their community, for family reunification, and for the children to have more opportunities. And it's mostly grade school-age children. And while I am skilled at doing one-on-one, I actually want to work with programs and implement some changes.
So what if I said I want you to take 1 month off, but you're not going to take it off? During that 1 month, you're going to make a list, the first day of that month, you're going to make a list of the 10 nonprofits that are most closely aligned with your values. And you're going to write a beautiful letter that's going to explain what you bring to the table, why you've developed these values, and ask if they'd be willing to have coffee with you. And you'll probably, if you send two, you'll be lucky to get two coffees. But the writing of the letters and having two coffees is going to, and having the space over a 1 month period to explore this. You might also want to read. You might want to go to a professional conference that deals with these people. Maybe you want to work in the court system. Maybe you want to just do this as a volunteer at CASA, as a court-appointed special advocate for kids, for poor kids. But doing that 1 month will help gain you clarity. To what extent does that feel like a good next step?
That feels like a very scary but realistic next step.
What's scary about? We have to stop it. We have just a few seconds. What's scary about that?
What if I'm successful? Oh my God!
And what would happen if you were successful?
I would be better than my parents. And are we allowed to do that?
Okay. So you know the answer to that question.
Yes,
I do. When you get off the phone, though, I want you to write a dialogue with yourself about you and with your wise twin sister. And you're saying, you know what, I don't know if I deserve to be better than my parents. And then you have your twin sister respond, and then you respond back until you've gotten clarity. Does that make sense?
Awesome.
All right. I'm glad you called Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you, sir.
You take care. And that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers, and I will talk with Charles Hugh Smith. He's the author of Why Things Are Falling Apart and What We Can Do About It. It's going to be a lot about where the jobs are for individuals and societally what we can do. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.